Welcome to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Oral History Project, where we work to record the oral histories of current and former DOC employees. I'm DOC Communications Director Susan McNaughton. This oral history focuses on memories from the October 1989 riot at the State Correctional Institution at Camp Hill. Our guest today, August 13, 2019, is Tab Bickle, who presently serves as the DOC's Executive Deputy Secretary for Institutional Operations. Thank you for joining us, Tab.
You're welcome.
Before we begin, could you please provide us with a brief overview of your DOC career, at which facilities you worked, and the titles that you held?
Yes. Well, I started out in Camp Hill in 1987. I went from Correctional Officer 1, Sergeant and Lieutenant at Camp Hill. In 1993, I transferred to the Academy as a Lieutenant, where I oversaw the CERT operation of the Department of Corrections. It was a little bit different back in them days. It wasn't as technology as we are now, which is good. It evolved very much. From there, I got promoted to Captain at SCI Cole Township. And that was, I think, 1996. And then I went to SCI Mahanoy, where I was promoted to Major and Deputy Superintendent for Facilities Management. And then in 2011, I went to SCI Huntington as the 19th superintendent in the oldest operating facility we have at that time. And I came up here to central office as a regional deputy secretary in June of 14. And from there, then with this parole merger, I got fortunate and got, well, all my positions I've been fortunate, but I got promoted to this. It was initially the chief deputy secretary, and it was ultimately made into the executive deputy secretary for institutional operations.
Great, great career. All right, so to the Camp Hill riot. Mm-hmm. You said you started in 87, so
yes.
How old were you in 1989 when the riot happened?
I was in my 20s.
Okay. Were you married at all, or?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so talk to us about how it started, where you were, and your experiences.
Okay, well, I remember it, as weird as that might seem or whatever, I remember it very vividly. I remember everything leading up to it through my course. I was a young correctional officer. I remember there was a lot of incidents going on. And when I mean incidents, just inmates not moving off the fields, things of that nature, and there wasn't really a whole bunch being done about it that I recall, as a young CO1. And it happened on a Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And I remember because I was off Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. And what I remember about that is I took Saturday off and I went up to a high school football game up in upstate New York. My Uncle Don's son, Craig, was playing football. My son was like one or two at that time, maybe a little bit older, three. And I took him up to this football game. It's just me and him. So we drove up to Port Jervis, New York, and then drove up to the football game. And it was a beautiful Saturday, warm afternoon. And it was the time I remembered him and I stopped at McDonald's. And I just remember that day so vividly, spending that time with my son.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came back, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, it was Wednesday. Came back to work, and I'd say it was probably around, I was on F block.
Okay.
F block was one of the more, at that time, Camp Hill, F and J block is where we kind of put our problematic inmates, as they say today, our level four inmates, as we recognize them today. They those two blocks never went to chow together. One went first, one went last. They never were in the same yard together. We just kept those inmates segregated. So I was running F block. And it was probably about maybe 3 o'clock. And I heard the commotion. I was actually upstairs on the running the switch blocks. Because when you came back in them days, your first day back, there was no sergeants that were assigned to the blocks at that time. There was a sergeant who oversaw everything, okay, like a line sergeant. So that wasn't available like they have now, where sergeants are kind of like assigned to blocks. It wasn't like that back then. So it was probably about 10 to 3, as I was saying, and I remember I heard all this loud noise, and I could look out F block, and I could see that in the main yard area, remember there was E, F, and G, and H, J, K in the blocks, and I could see, and then I saw a officer getting attacked by a bunch of inmates. And then next thing you know, it was just really chaotic, like really quick. So what I remember about it at that point was you realized what was happening very quickly. I don't know if you realized the magnitude of it, but you knew something wasn't right.
Right.
Okay, very quickly. At that point, I remember that the inmates, and this is some of the good things that have happened since then. One key got you everywhere. One door key got you everywhere. So that, you know, once those inmates got the keys, they were coming through our side door, what we call the day room. They were coming from E block. And I realized that we were in trouble. And remember, this is probably 5-6 minutes into this incident. So it was really, I could look out and see it was really getting heavy. The inmates actually came in. What I actually did is I jumped off the tier down onto to the first tier. And the officer I was with was named Randy Wright. I don't know if I should put Randy out there or not.
Okay, but let's say the officer I was with.
Right, the officer I was with, he actually, we got it ourselves into the switch box before we could get caught.
Okay, can you explain to people what the switch box is?
Yes, the switch box was a lower area where you actually ran the it was like a control center almost. They were levers at that point. There was no push buttons. Everything was levers and cables, and you know, that's how you would open a door. You just pull a lever down and that would open the doors. The doors were numbered, and that's what we did. So we locked ourselves into the switch box area. And the one thing I remember, there was a sergeant who told me, I don't know why he ever told me this, but he probably told a group of us, that if you take your switch box key or your door key into the switch box and you turn it halfway, if anybody else has a key, they can't get in. Mm-hmm. So I remembered that this sergeant told me that, and it worked. They could not get into into our switch box. And remember, this is evolving now. Now we're maybe a half hour into this. Okay, and it's bad. Radios back in them days were what they were. They didn't work. I mean, it's not like we have today. That's what I'm saying. This is where we evolved to, you know, so much better. So I remember we were making phone calls into the control center and telling them, you know, we're getting ready to be taken here, and there really wasn't much they could do. I mean, control, so we just stopped making the phone calls.
I thought I read some radio transmissions. Was that you on the radio asking control for help?
Yes, I was probably on the radio a few times asking control for help, asking anybody for help.
And there was a lot of swearing in the background, I guess. These were the inmates threatening to come in and get you?
Yeah, that was happening as we were doing that. Yes, there was a lot of conversations. It was a very hot day, by the way. It was almost like that Sunday. And the reason I brought up about my son is because as I get into this further, he's who I thought about. When all this stuff was going down, he's actually what I thought about, you know, to put my head where it needed to be. But so as this evolved, I mean, it was a warm day. The fans were still on the blocks. Remember, this was no air conditioning in Camp Hill at that time. And so they were trying to break into the switch box, mm-hmm. and they couldn't get in. So what they did then, they actually broke our window a little bit, and they were throwing fire bombs. I mean, again, this is evolving. Where are they getting all this stuff? Later I find out, you know, there was everything back then, but everything in the jail. I mean, people were bringing in their motorcycles there. If you look at the tapes, you can see a guy out there on a 4x4 just running around, you know, on somebody's personal. That stuff's all done now for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. So they were trying to shoot fireballs into our switch box. So myself and the officer, we flooded the floor to try to help with that. Well, what they tried to do then was they tried to cut the fan, the wires that were on the fan to the cord to try to electrocute us.
Oh.
Anyway, that's what I was thinking. I'm pretty sure that's what they were trying to do. Now, quite naturally, it never worked. Eventually, we knew this wasn't going to get good. They started breaking. They actually got hammers and whatever they had, sledgehammers, whatever they were doing, and they were actually breaking into the switch box. As this occurred, okay, breaking into it. And then what happened was, after they broke into the first one, there was this beam, there was just this metal beam. And I thought to myself, I told my partner that they're not going to be able to get in here, because when he built this, they put these beams so that if they would do something like this, but no, that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. Eventually, they just went a little bit higher. Eventually, they actually broke in, you know, just put a hole into the wall and came to the switch box, and that's when they got myself and my officer, where so they these, where they actually took us hostage.
These were concrete, like cinder block type
yes,
of walls
they, yeah,
with
were.
Grouting in between, and that's how they were able to just kind of...
Yeah, very thin blocks.
Okay.
Yes, very, very thin. I don't know what when Camp Hill was built, but it wasn't very...
1940s.
Yeah, it wasn't very sturdy.
Okay.
I mean, it was very easy for them to get through once they realized there was no beams anywhere.
Right.
So it didn't take them long to penetrate into the switchbox area.
Okay.
But the key thing that the sergeant told me worked to the very end.
Nice.
They could never get into the front door.
But they did get in.
Yes, they broke in that way, and then they took us out through the... They opened up the thing and then took us out.
And then what?
At that point, they, you know, there was a lot of threatening going on, a lot of punches. You know, they handcuffed us. My partner had thick glasses. I remember they took his glasses and they crunched them. They just stepped on them so he couldn't really see anything. But they wound up separating us, and I was handcuffed. I was kind of like hogtied. I got handcuffed pretty much. Originally, I was handcuffed with my legs and my hands together almost. You know, not a good position to be in. So they did that, and then eventually, you know, there was a lot of threats being made.
Did they blindfold you?
Yes, they covered me up then. And then a couple inmates that were on the block with us came up and asked if we were okay, and I told them, hey, the handcuffs were tight. So they got me to that real vulnerable position and then just put me in the regular handcuffs. And then they loosened them up. And then they just started walking us around. You know, just started walking. Again, I eventually met up with other hostages. I can't remember who they were. I remember one, but can't really remember who they were anymore. You know, I remember, but I can't remember,
right.
If that
did,
makes sense.
Did they walk you through that common yard?
Yes, yes. They walked us. I think if you look at the tapes, you might see some
yeah.
things. I had hair back then.
But your head was covered, so we wouldn't
yes.
have been able to see
yeah.
that.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, okay, and that night went on till about 11:30. How did that end for you that night?
Well, eventually, I'm not sure what happened, but they, you know, again, we were being led over, inmate clothes, the whole nine yards, and back in the officer clothes. It was kind of very weird, just very weird, you know, as you go through this process. You weren't real sure what was going to happen to you. Again, there was a lot of threats in physical, sexual, you know, just that people were saying to you, what was going to happen. And that's where I told you I started thinking about my son, you know, because there were times that they just... Remember, this was a period of time where they just left you sit there. And then I was around some other hostages you really couldn't see. You really weren't saying a whole bunch. You know, you're just hoping that somebody come get your ass. And, you know, you'd be all right at the end of this. Again, our CERT back in them days are nothing compared to what they are now. They were a bunch of brave guys and women who put on a helmet and had a baton and some type of body armor, and they were willing to go in to fight. Not like we have now. You know, so that was another good thing about that. But they were brave. But eventually how it ended for me on the first night was they came and got me. In fact, the inmates.
Okay.
Like the leaders of the inmates.
Okay.
I don't know if I can say their names. I don't know if we want to get into
that.
But the leader of the inmates came and got me. And what I remember about it, what I truly remember about it was they surrounded us. And I remember when I was being walked out, I felt like the heavyweight champ of the world. If you can picture, like, being led into the ring where the crowd's just around you and your entourage busts you through the group of inmates. And they took me down to what they call E-gate. And at that point, there was almost like a struggle. Like, the officers, there was a couple of lieutenants there, and they grabbed me. Then the inmates weren't sure they were going to let me go, so it was like a little... tug of war.
Could you see at this point?
Yes, I
okay.
can see. I can see what was going on.
Okay.
Yeah, I can see. And, you know, I still had handcuffs on, and then he just, eventually I just got pulled over to the, onto the correctional officer side.
Okay. And then from there, medical triage or what?
Yeah.
Again,
I don't want to put anybody down, but it was totally different back then than
right.
it is now. There was, I mean, I did get interviewed, but nothing like you would now. I mean, nobody really asked a lot of questions. I did get some medical looked at.
Because there was a lot of first responders outside the main gate, which
correct.
Is where kind of triage took place. So did you get into an ambulance right there and they took you to a
yes,
hospital?
Yes, I think I eventually did somehow get into an ambulance. Yes, and I eventually went to a hospital, and then I eventually came back to the institution. That's what I remember.
Okay, you came back to the institution when?
That night.
That night?
Yes, and that's when some people wanted to interview me.
Some people meaning PSP?
No,
or?
I don't think I really talked to the PSP initially that night.
So it was corrections?
It was corrections
people?
People.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, and so then how long did you work once you came back? When did you go home again?
Well, believe it or not, again, I was in my 20s. I actually went home that night. And I mean, I was shook up like anybody would be. You know, my ribs hurt, my nose hurt, my eyes were black and blue. And I remember I actually went back to the hospital that morning.
Okay,
because I worried about my ribs, and they said, we don't think they're broke, but stay off work. Well, again, being young, I went back to work the very next night on October 26th on a 2 to 10 shift. And as people realize, when we got in there, you could see, like, I went right back to F block. And again, today, that would never happen. Oh, you'll edit this in, right? So I'm not, like,
yep.
I don't want to sound like a hero. But it'll be, so today they would never allow Tab Bickle to get back into an institution after something like, they just won't let you in there, okay? But they did, and I went back to F block, and when you got up there, you could just tell we got problems. I could see inmates down the tier. You got to remember, this place was destroyed, okay? It was destroyed. And you could just see inmates running back and forth from the tiers, like coming out of their cells, because they ripped, again, it was all a cable system, and they could reach up. They ripped all the metal boxes off, and they could legitimately reach out of the cell and click their cell door open. I mean, they could legitimately do that. That's why we were trying to get the chains in there, but I guess there wasn't enough chains. Again, so much better now. It would never happen that way now.
Right.
If we got to that point. So you knew there was issues going on, and
that must have been eerie. Just knowing that you're seeing these inmates running back and forth, thinking
it's almost like a movie to me. You know that I watched this, and then the hours just went by, and I'll jump ahead. I just remember the captain yelled, "Abandon the post! Everybody get out! You know, we're losing the jail." I mean, I remember that radio call coming over. So we all ran out of our blocks, or anyway I did, and everybody else did, except for a couple people that got caught that second night up there. And I went down to E-Gate, and we actually ran across the whole compound. And remember, Camp Hill was so dingily lit back in them days. Again, it would never be like that now. And we went into where what they would, at that point, used to be the captain's office, the records office, the control center was all right there. And then we locked ourselves into that control center. Okay, this is the old control center back in Camp Hill.
Right.
And there was a bunch of us in there. And we kind of got trapped. By the way, when we started running, when we were told the abandoned post, the inmates were breaking out. I could hear the cracking. I wasn't sure what was happening, but they were breaking out of their cells. And it just happened so fast. And they were actually chasing us, pretty much across the compound till we got into this control center, that walkway past the Ed building. And
so they were through that gate.
Yes. E-gate. Oh yeah, E-gate. Yeah, they got through.
It was
that
gone.
Yeah, they,
okay.
Yep, and they got right through there, and they were chasing us down into here, right. Okay. Into the control center. Now group one, this is group one at that point, probably still is group one. They never really, I don't think a whole bunch of them ever got out.
Okay. We're looking at the map right now of the institution as it was in 1989. So, okay, second night, and there's several of you now are...
Bunch of us. They actually have video of this, too.
Locked in.
Yes.
In there, including the prison's spokesperson.
There were so many people in there.
Really?
I remember there was a state policeman in there. There was actually somebody who was videotaping this, because I remember after everything settled, and I'll tell you what happened to us that night. But after everything settled, and they were looking at the tapes. I remember the lawyers telling me, you're probably going to get sued because I was using mace to try to get him away. I was actually seen on tape going up, pushing
and
mace.
And they said, you're probably going
to I think they were having a joke with me, how it works. You know what I mean? But it was still weird to hear. But anyway, so long story short, again, they were trying to firebomb us. They were really, truly trying to firebomb us in there. And it was really getting smoky. And I just remember when I was up front and I turned around and there was really nobody there. I don't know where everybody went. It was real smoky. So I went into where the old records area used to be, which is now, I believe, the deputies area. But I went back into there and I could just see everything blazing. It was just completely on fire. So when I came out, I couldn't find anybody. I ran into a old correctional officer, older correctional officer at that time. And him and I, we found each other and we couldn't find everybody else. So what we eventually made our way into was into the staff bathroom, which, by the way, was never unlocked. You had to get a key to it. And I just said, please be unlocked.
Wow.
So this staff bathroom was legitimately unlocked. And myself and this officer, his name was Loper, by the way. You don't have to tell that, but he had MS or something. He was in bad shape. But him and I went into this bathroom. And we just sat in there, and we were both like, man, don't get us. You know, we're like, don't let this happen again. So you could just hear like, and I mean legitimately, I could hear shotgun blasts. I could hear like what I thought were shotgun blasts. I could hear like right next to us, this bathroom used to be the old security office. So what they did, what the inmates did, they got over there quicker. They pushed the air conditioner in, because they want to get in the security office. They're probably looking for the drugs and stuff that were in the security office, is what I assumed. So, you know, we're just sitting there hoping and praying that these inmates don't come in to this bathroom and find us, which they never did. So we waited for a period of time. You could kind of hear that the police and the correction officers were now out there in the, anyway, what I thought was, so I told the partner I was with, I said, look, I'm getting out of here. I'm going to make a run for it. He didn't want to go, but I said, I got to get out of here. Okay, I knew where I was at. I knew the area. So I came out through the security office. And, of course, at this time, I took my shirts and stuff off. So I, in my mind, and I really mean this, I was thinking if an inmate saw me, I could make a dash to the front gate and try to have him catch me. Okay, I was young then. I could go. So when I got out there, I actually ran into state police and correction officers who identified me, because they were pointing weapons. They weren't real sure who was who. I mean, it was chaotic.
Right.
And so they identified me. It was Mark Grove, Joe Miller. Remember old Joe Miller?
Yeah, yeah.
Yep, Major Miller. He was out there. They all had shotguns. And they identified who I was. And so I told him, I said, the other officer's still in there. So we were yelling for him, and he won't come out, because I think he thought we were setting him up. There was somebody. So we actually crawled back in there, got him. And then we got out, and that's what happened to me on the second night. Probably more terrifying than the first night.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because you just say to yourself, what am I doing back in this institution? Why am I back in here? Why am I caught in this closet? You know, why am I doing this? But, yep.
So then, when did you go back to work after that?
The next day. The very next day. I was there when they were pulling them off the Group 1 fields and they were opening up, I believe it was it Waymart?
Yes.
Or was it Retreat?
No, they opened Waymart. Early.
The night of the riots.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember them coming off the bus.
Okay.
And I remember I was out there and I was just looking around, and then I remember Lieutenant Hartman, who became our major, Uncle Dale, Major Hartman, spotted me. And he was the first guy that I think realized, and I don't know if you, but like realized, like, hey, big, you know, some of these guys don't belong here. So he pulled me out and put me at the front gate and said, gave direct orders that these guys aren't supposed, I don't want them inside this institution till we get some clearances on everybody, what's going on. And then it just went from there. I just kept coming back for work. Eventually, I did take some time off. I was kind of like directed to. And it really came down because I was there for a while, but the hearing started kind of fast. And that's when it really hit me the worst. was when I had to go testify.
Okay.
Because then all that stuff kept coming up, and I seen a lot. You know, I've seen a lot, and, you know, being held like that the first night, the second, you know, I seen an awful lot.
Right.
And I knew who the players were.
Okay.
That anyway that were talking to me, I knew who they were.
Right. So one of my questions is, how do you get through the trauma of what you experienced?
I don't know. I don't know how I did it. I mean, I got lucky. I mean, I think there was a time in my life. Actually, that Friday night, I went to a high school football game. Lebanon was playing Wilson. And that's when Kerry Collins left Lebanon to play for Wilson. We should have had him. Lebanon could have won the championship that night. But I remember going to that game, but I remember the roar of the crowd truly upset me that night.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, I didn't show it, but I felt it. Because it was like I just heard the roar of those inmates. So that affected me.
So that was another question I was going to ask you is, did you have nightmares or any kind of physical or emotional reactions? So there, the roar of the crowd at the football game was one, but how about nightmares?
No.
No?
No, I never had any nightmares. I never had, I think I got angry, but I never, I don't know why, I just never had anything that affected me that way.
And how did your family react to your involvement?
Well, I think I never really talked about it that much. I mean, my son was too little, and I just didn't really talk about it. So I never really discussed it.
Were you ever debriefed? I remember at Central Office, like Dr. Lance and
yes.
John Ream were having
yes.
debriefings
yes.
in the basement. Did you?
Yeah, somebody debriefed me. I don't remember. I don't. I just remember I was talking to somebody. It might have been Lance Cordier.
Yeah.
I think it might have been him.
Right.
It might have been him that debriefed me.
Okay, so let's change gears a little bit and talk about how you've seen changes be implemented over the years as a result of the riot. What can you mention?
Everything. Staffing. Gear. I mean, just the OC that we carry. The radios. The good radios we have. The PAR alarms. I mean, what I mean by that is where the alarms that go off to let you know it's the wave system. And every institution has one now. So if something happens and you hit that, they're going to know where you're at. Everybody carries a radio now, and a good radio for the most part. You know, it's not like it was back then with mics. The lighting in the institutions are better. The staffing is phenomenal compared back to then. We got unit managers now. Back in them days, I didn't even know what a counselor was. You didn't see a counselor. They weren't on the cell blocks, you know, like they are now.
Oh, wow.
You know, so you didn't have that interaction like you do then.
How about keys?
Yes, they. You know, everything got rekeyed.
So again, I just want to make this clear. So every staff member, officer, had one key and could get everywhere in the institution.
Not everywhere, but door keys. Like if you were the main block officer, you had a door key. If you had E block's door key, you had F, all the other block's door keys.
Okay.
That's how it was back. It's just one little key that you would utilize.
Wow.
Yes.
So
there was no, just even the day room keys were one key throughout the whole group two and three side. Okay, so yes, so everything got refigured that way. Departmentalized, compartmentalized, however you want to say
interior
it.
Interior fencing?
Yes, definitely interior fencing. There's just so much. Training is so much better.
All the specialty teams?
Yes, specialty teams. And again, the men and women that served on those specialty teams back then were brave and gave everything they had, but there wasn't much for us, you know. I mean, you wore, like I said, you legitimately wore an old helmet, and they were brave to do it, and put on some turtle suit that didn't do shit, and gave you a baton, and you went in there, and that's how those people did it.
I do remember seeing several guys, I'm presuming they were guys, in black outfits, carrying a gurney between the two fences of the perimeter to pick up a hostage.
Yep. That might have been right in front of the, the highway tower.
Yeah.
Right in front of the highway tower.
Right behind Central Office.
Yes, the highway tower. I actually remember who that officer was.
Okay.
And they actually let him out because he had a diabetic problem. And I believe I was on G block when that happened. I actually saw a little bit of that happen. I believe he might have even been in my group that they pulled him out because the inmates didn't want him to die, quite naturally. Those inmates didn't.
Changes to tools.
Oh yeah, it's scripted. Even what I talked about, where they got this this fuel to start these fires. They wouldn't have that anymore. I mean, they would allow you to bring in power. You know, we actually had chainsaws in there.
Acetylene torches?
Yes. Getting repaired. I mean, it was just...
And there were car, like auto body shop stuff too.
Yes, inside there. It was.
Remember seeing a truck drive through an interior fence.
Yep, it was just so different back then. All that stuff's changed through the years. The training's better, staffing's better, the equipment's better.
I talked to former Secretary Beard, who said back then, like you said, the CERT team just wasn't very well trained and they weren't properly equipped.
No.
He said helmets were even hard to come by.
Right, correct.
Amazing. So that's totally changed. So we have hostage rescue, hostage negotiation, CREST, Corrections
right.
Rifle Specialist Teams,
right.
And CERT, and they're all mandated to do training annually?
Yes, they have. They get a lot of hours, which is well worth it. I can't quote the hours right now, but it's certainly sufficient, you know, and the staff that do that, you know, I'm very, very grateful for them, because I do believe this. I truly believe this. If I would have had those trained HRT guys and CERT guys and the CRIS guys up top, I really believe that, first of all, I don't think we'd ever get to that level. I mean, anything can happen in our business. We get that. I'm not naive enough to think that it can happen here, because it can. I get it. That's what we deal with. But I think we have done so much in order for it to get to that magnitude. I don't think, I think it would be very hard to get there. I really believe that, you know, just as long as everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Right.
And I really believe that if we do have a situation like that, our HRT and our CRIST and our CERT and our HNT are highly trained, skilled, and dedicated people who would do what they need to do to get these people out of those type situations. I'm very confident that would happen.
Yeah.
Now.
Talk to me about trends or ways in which the DOC now watches to determine if something is brewing, for the lack of a better term.
Well, we definitely have, we got our intel units now, which really help us.
Because there were signs leading up to the
Capitol riot. Oh, absolutely. There was more than signs. There was big signs.
Yeah.
There was movie theater signs telling you something's going to happen.
Like what?
Just not coming off the yard.
Yeah.
Not coming out of the chow hall. Things were just moving very, very slow.
Were
you
they
just
hoarding commissary, you think?
I don't think so. I don't think
okay.
they needed to.
Okay.
I don't think they really needed to.
Wow.
I mean, these are a bunch of young dudes back then. No, I don't think they needed to. I don't remember that. I just remember just the disrespect and the slow movement. People just coming off the field when they felt like it, coming out of the chow hall when they felt like it.
Wow.
Those are the things that I remember. That nowadays, I believe that we would immediately be alerted to that and take the appropriate action to ensure it doesn't escalate into a bigger event.
But now you do have ways to track things like if commissary sales just spike or grievances.
I think they had it back then, but yeah, I agree with that. You know, weekly status reports. I mean, there's a lot of things that we're looking at. You know, we run a leadership meeting every Tuesday morning with all the superintendents and the parole people. But we also run every 6 weeks now where we run a 2-hour meeting to where we're all telling each other what we're doing and what we're doing good. We have so much intel come out. We have a weekly weapons find, a weekly drug find, of what's happening throughout the entire Commonwealth. So there's a lot of information coming down that staff can take advantage of. You know, our security officers have grown. You know, back then I believe it was a lieutenant. Now you have a captain, 3 lieutenants. You have an intel lieutenant, so there's just a lot of stuff that we're doing. We have phone monitoring that I don't think they had back then. I'm not saying they did or didn't.
Yeah.
I don't remember it as we would now, where we can really just pick things up. I don't be careful, you know, that we get a lot of intel from.
Right. So talk to me again about testifying against the inmates, because that's one of my questions. How did that impact you in both preparing for it and then, you know, just the thought of having to relive all of that, recall everything that you went through again.
Yeah, that was probably the hardest part for me, just getting in front of, and then they consolidated them, so you're up there and there's like 6 inmates that you're testifying in front of, 6 different lawyers. It was quite the show and it definitely stressed me.
Yeah.
It was one of the things that definitely stressed me, and I remember it. Yeah.
So how do you get through that stress again? You say you just
dealt with it.
Yeah.
You know, I just dealt with it.
Yeah.
I mean, things were different back then. They didn't have the, I'm not even sure if they had the SEEP.
Oh.
Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I don't know. If they did, I don't remember it.
Right.
And there wasn't really anything like that, in
right.
my opinion,
okay.
like we would have nowadays.
Right.
You know?
SEEP is the State Employee Assistance Program. So there are several of these key inmates still in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And as your capacity as EDS, Executive Deputy Secretary, do you ever run into them? Do they know who you are? How do you interact?
Yes. I run into them. They know who I am, and I know who they are. And we interact well.
Okay.
We're you know, again, we were all in our 20s back then. Now we're all men, and I think things are looked at a little bit different.
Are they treated differently because of their involvement?
I think initially they might have been. I think it's 30 years ago now, and in a department back then, I can't remember what it was, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 jails compared to where we are now, you know, from, 10,000 inmates to whatever it is, 48,000 now, 47,000. So it's a whole different ball game now.
Have any of those inmates ever said, "Hey, man, I'm sorry"?
No, I never really got to that level with them. Most of them I see were involved in the riots. Only one or two were that I remember were directly involved with me that are still into the system.
Mm-hmm. What should employees know about riot situations if one would happen today? What should they do?
Well, if you get taken hostage, I just thought positive things about, like I said, about my son. I didn't really argue with them, with the inmates. Again, it was so chaotic. I mean, I must have been around 100 inmates, different inmates that were leading me around. It really wasn't just one inmate. And I'll say it just like this, there were inmates as much that hurt me, as much as helped me.
Mm-hmm.
By loosening up them handcuffs, get me out of that vulnerable position I was in.
Right.
Stopping them from punching you with the cheap shots. There were inmates that did that.
Right.
So, you try to remember that too.
Is
that
there
answer
any other
the question?
Yeah, I
okay.
think so. Is there any other kind of advice that you'd like to share, or is there anything that we've missed that you'd like to touch on?
No, I just think that that things are so much better now. Again, I will never say it can happen, but I think with all the things that we have in place, it's something to get to that level. I would hope never would. It's a terrible thing to go through. I mean, here it is 30 years later, and we're still, we still talk about it. And there's a lot of people who still like to talk about it or want to know about it. I used to go down to the academy and talk to the hostage negotiation class. I stopped doing that because that wore me out.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had me in the basic training class a couple times, and it just wears you out if you keep, because I like to move forward. I've been very, I've probably been one of the most lucky people in this department to get where I've got, the positions I've been put in. So I'm always grateful for that and thankful. And I hope nobody ever gets in one of those positions. It's not a good feeling. It's horrible. You're very vulnerable, and it's scary. And so I hope nobody ever has to go through that. Or even the assaults. We take that, that's one thing I can tell you I take very seriously. My philosophy in corrections is very simple. And it has been and always will be. No inmate escapes, no staff assaults, physical plant. If you can do those three things, and what I mean by physical plant, the PIDs, the running of your institutions, if you can take care of all that, I think your jails will be somewhat fine. And it's a different inmate nowadays too. It's a much more complex inmate than it was back then. They were more simple then, just like the world. The world's more complex now than it ever was. And the inmates and people are the same. Just more complex in your dealings with them. More legally, more lawsuit savvy, things like that.
Okay.
That it?
That's it. Thank you for taking time to share your recollections with us.
No problem.